You're listening to the Berkshire Hathaway Annual Shareholders Meeting Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Yahoo Finance.
Partnerships and businesses, and they wouldn't look at them as chips to move around up or down. We will just now take a quick look. And I see we've got Becky's email address. So if you have questions on what I've said or other things, you can email these questions. And she is back there, probably sort of a madhouse trying to handle questions coming in and pick out the one she's going to prioritize. But feel free to anything I've talked about so far to send along to her. And we'll keep her address up when I later hold the formal part of the meeting, too. Very briefly, in terms of Berkshire, in the first quarter, you'll put up. We have the slides on that. There we are. Our operating earnings were, and there's much more about this in the 10Q, and it's really not worth spending any real time on, but the operating earnings for the first quarter have no meaning whatsoever in terms of forecasting what's going to happen the next year. And I don't know the consequences of shutting down the American economy. I know eventually it will work, whatever we do. We may make mistakes. We will make mistakes, and I'm not during this talk, and later on, I'm not going to be second-guessing people on this because nobody knows for sure what any alternative action would produce or anything of the sort. But what we do know is that for some period, certainly during the balance of the year, but it could go on a considerable period of time, who knows. But our operating earnings will be less, considerably less, than if the virus hadn't come along. I mean, it hurts some of our businesses a lot. I mean, you shut down. Some of our businesses have effectively been shut down. It affects others much less. Our three major businesses of insurance and the BNSF Railroad, and our energy business, those are our three largest by some margin. They're in a reasonably decent position. They'll spend more than their depreciation. So some of the earnings will go, along with depreciation, will go toward increasing fixed assets. But basically, these businesses will produce cash even though their earnings decline somewhat. And if we'll go to part two, we keep ourselves in an extraordinarily strong position. We'll always do that. That's fundamental. We insure people. We're a specialist to some extent and a leader. It's not our main business, but we sell structured settlements. That means somebody gets in a terrible accident, usually an auto accident, and they're going to require care for 10, 30, 50 years, and their family or their lawyer is wise enough, in our view, to, rather than take some big cash settlement, to essentially arrange to have money paid over the lifetime of the individual to take care of their medical bills or whatever it may be. And we're a large, we've got many, many, many people that, in effect, have staked their well-being on the promises of Berkshire to take care of them for, like I say, 50 years or longer into the future. And, now, I would never take real chances with money of other people's money under any circumstances. Both Charlie and I come from a background where we ran partnerships. I started mine in 1956. For really seven, either actual family members or the equivalent. And Charlie did the same thing 6 years later. And we never, neither one of us, I think, I know I didn't, I'm virtually certain the same is true of Charlie. Neither one of us ever had a single institution investment with us. I mean, every single bit of money we managed for other people was from individuals, people with faces attached to them. But, or entities, or money with faces attached to them. And so we've always felt that our job is basically that of a trustee and hopefully a reasonably smart trustee in terms of what we were trying to accomplish. But the trustee aspect has been very important. And it's true for the people with the structured settlements. It's true for up and down the line. But it's true for the owners very much, too. So we always operate from a position of strength. Now, I show on the slide that's up, I show our, well, let's go back one. I show our net, our cash and treasury bill position on March 31st. And you might look at that and say, well, you've got 125 billion or so in cash and treasury bills, and you've got, at least at that point, we had about 180 billion or so in equities, and you can say, well, that's a huge position to have in treasury bills versus just 180 billion in equities. But we really have far more than that in equities because we own a lot of businesses. We own 100% of the stock of a great many businesses, which to us are very similar to the marketable stocks we own. We just don't own them all. They don't have a quote on them. But we have hundreds of billions of wholly owned businesses. So they are 124 billion is not some, 40% or so cash positions. It's far less than that. And we will always keep plenty of cash on hand, and for any circumstances, if a 9/11 comes along, if the stock market is closed as it was in World War I, it's not going to be, but, I didn't think we were going to be having a pandemic when I watched that Creighton-Villanova game in January either. So we want to be in a position at Berkshire where, you remember Blanche DuBois and the In A Streetcar Named Desire, that goes back before many of you, but she said she didn't want in Blanche's case, she said that she's dependent on the kindness of strangers, and we don't want to be dependent on the kindness of friends even, because there are times when money almost stops. And we had one of those, interestingly enough. We had it, of course, in 2008 and 9. But right around the day or two, leading up to March 23rd, we came very close, but fortunately we had a Federal Reserve that knew what to do. But we money was... investment-grade companies were essentially going to be frozen out of the market. CFOs all over the country had been taught to sort of maximize returns on equity capital, so they financed themselves to some extent through commercial paper because that was very cheap and it was backed up by bank lines and all of that. And they let the debt creep up quite a bit at many companies. And then, of course, they had the hell scared out of them by what was happening in markets, particularly the equity markets. And so they rushed to draw down lines of credit, and that surprised the people who had extended those lines of credit. They got very nervous. And the capacity of Wall Street to absorb a rush to liquidity that was taking place in mid-March was strained to the limit, to the point where the Federal Reserve, observing these markets, decided they had to move in a very big way. We got to the point where the U.S. Treasury market, the deepest of all markets, got somewhat disorganized. And when that happens, believe me, every bank and CFO in the country knows it, and they react with fear, and fear is the most contagious disease you can imagine. It makes the virus look like a biker. And we came very close to having a total freeze of credit to the largest companies in the world who were depending on it. And to the great credit of Jay Powell, I've always had Paul Volcker up on a special place, special pedestal in terms of Federal Reserve chairman over the years. We've had a lot of very good Fed chairmen, but Paul Volcker, I had him at the top of the list, and I'll recommend another book. Paul Volcker died about a year ago or a little less, but not much before he died. He wrote a book called Keeping At It. And if you call my friends with the bookworm, I think you'll enjoy reading that book. Paul Volcker was a giant. In many ways, he was a big guy, too. He and Jay Powell couldn't see more in temperament or anything. But Jay Powell, in my view, and the Fed board belong up there on that pedestal because they acted in the middle of March, probably somewhat instructed by what they'd seen in 2008 and 2009. They reacted in a huge way and essentially allowed what's happened since that time to play out the way it has. March, where the market had essentially frozen, closed a little after mid-month, ended up, because the Fed took these actions on March 23rd, it ended up being the largest month for corporate debt issuance, I believe, in history. And then April followed through and was even a larger month. And you saw all kinds of companies grabbing everything, coming to market, and spreads actually narrowed. And every one of those people that issued bonds in late March and April, I sent a thank you letter to the Fed, because it would not have happened if they hadn't operated with really unprecedented speed and determination. And we'll know the consequences of swelling the Fed's balance sheet. You can look at the Fed's balance sheet. They put it out every Thursday. Kind of interesting reading if you're sort of a nut like me. But it's up there on the internet every Thursday, and you'll see some extraordinary changes there in the last 6 or 7 weeks. And like I say, we don't know the consequences of that, and nobody does exactly. And we don't know the consequences of what undoubtedly we'll have to do, but we do know the consequences of doing nothing. And that's would have been the tendency of the Fed in many years past, not doing nothing, but doing something inadequate. But Mario Draghi, brought the whatever it takes to Europe, and the Fed in mid-March sort of did whatever it takes squared, and we owe them a huge thank you. But we're prepared at Berkshire. We always prepare on the basis that maybe the Fed will not have a chairman that acts like that, and we really want to be prepared for anything. So that explains some of the $124 billion in cash and bills. We don't need it all, but we do never want to be dependent on not only the kindness of strangers, but the kindness of friends. Now, in the next slide, we have what we did in inequities, and these numbers are tiny when you get right down to it. I mean, for having 500 billion or so in net worth, and I mean, not in net worth, but in market value at the start of the year or something close to that, we bought in 1.7 billion of stock, and our purchases were a couple of billion more than our sales of equities. But as you saw in the previous slide, we had operating earnings of almost 6 billion. So we did very, very little in the first quarter. And then I've added another figure, which I wouldn't normally present to you, but I want to be sure that if I'm talking to you about investments in stocks more than I usually have, I want you to know what Berkshire's actually doing. Now, you'll see in the month of April that we net sold $6 billion or so of securities, and that isn't because we thought the stock market was going to go down or anything of the sort, or because somebody changes their target price or they change this year's earnings forecast. I just decided that I'd made a mistake in evaluating. It was an understandable mistake. It was a probability weighted decision when we bought that we were getting an attractive amount for our money when investing across the airlines business. So we bought roughly 10% of the four largest airlines, and we probably, this is not 100% of what we did in April, but we probably paid $7 or $8 billion, and somewhere between $7 and $8 billion, to own 10% of the four large companies in the airline business. And we felt for that, we were getting $1 billion roughly of earnings. Now, we weren't getting $1 billion of dividends, but we felt our share of the underlying earnings was $1 billion, and we felt that that number was more likely to go up than down over a period of time. It would be cyclical, obviously, but it was as if we bought the whole company, but we bought it through the New York Stock Exchange, and we can only effectively buy 10% roughly of the four. And we treat it mentally exactly as if we were buying a business. And it turned out I was wrong about that business because of something that was not in any way the fault of four excellent CEOs. I mean, they, believe me, no joy being a CEO of an airline, but the companies we bought were well-managed. They did a lot of things right. It's a very, very, very difficult business because you're dealing with millions of people every day, and if something goes wrong for 1% of them, they are very unhappy. So I don't envy anybody the job of being CEO of an airline, but I particularly don't enjoy them being in a period like this where essentially people have been told basically not to fly. I've been told not to fly for a while. I'm looking forward to flying. I may not fly commercial, but that's another question. But the airline business, and I may be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong, but I think it changed in a very major way, and it's obviously changed in the fact that their four companies are each going to borrow, you know, perhaps an average of at least 10 or 12 billion each. Well, you have to pay that back out of earnings over some period of time. I mean, you're 10 or 12 billion dollars worse off if that happens. And of course, in some cases, they're having to sell stock or sell the right to buy a stock at these prices. And that takes away from the upside down. And I don't know whether 2 or 3 years from now that as many people will fly as many passenger miles as they did last year. They may and they may not. But the future is much less clear to me about how the business will turn out through absolutely no fault of the airlines themselves. But something that was a low probability event happened, and it happened to hurt particularly whether it's the travel business, the hotel business, the cruise business, the theme park business, but the airline business in particular. And of course, the airline business has the problem that if the business comes back 70% or 80%, the aircraft don't disappear. So you've got too many planes. And then it didn't look that way when the orders were placed a few months ago or when arrangements were made. But the world changed for airlines, and I wish them well, but it's one of the businesses we have. We have businesses we own directly that are going to be hurt significantly. The virus will cost Berkshire money. It doesn't cost money because our stock and various other businesses moves around. I mean, if XYZ, which is, say, is one of our holdings, and we own it as a business and we like the business, the stock goes down 20 or 30 or 40%, we don't feel we're poorer in that situation. We felt we were poorer in terms of what actually happened to those airline businesses, just as if we'd owned 100% of them. So that explains those sales, which are relatively minor, but I want to make sure that nobody thinks that involves a market prediction. And that pretty well wraps it up for Berkshire. So now we move into the formal part of the meeting, which will be followed by a fairly extended question and answer period if there are a lot of questions with Becky. And while we're doing this formal part of the meeting, it's not too exciting. So feel free to leave your whatever you're viewing this through, and if you want to send questions to Becky, we'll keep her contact information up on the screen. Or if you want to pick yourself a sandwich or do anything else, we will now move. Or you can pay attention to the formal part of the meeting. But we will do this and won't take too long, and then we will move on to the question and answer meeting. So with that, I will call the meeting to order, and this follows the script, as if you can't tell by what I'm saying. I'm Warren Buffett, Chairman of the Board of Directors of the company, and I welcome you to this 2020 Annual Meeting of Shareholders. Mark Hamburg is Secretary of Berkshire Hathaway, and he will make a written record of the proceedings. Dan Jaksich has been appointed Inspector of Elections at this meeting. He will certify to the count of votes cast in the election for directors and the motions to be voted upon at this meeting. The named proxy holders for this meeting are Walter Scott and Mark Hamburg. Does the Secretary have a report of the number of Berkshire shares outstanding entitled to vote and represented at the meeting?
Yes, I do. As indicated in the proxy statement that accompanied this note, the notice of this meeting that was sent to all shareholders of record on March 4th, 2020, the record date for this meeting, there were 699,123 shares of Class A Berkshire Hathaway common stock outstanding, with each share entitled to one vote on motions considered at the meeting, and 1,382,352,370 shares of Class B Berkshire Hathaway common stock outstanding, with each share entitled to 1/10,000th of one vote on motions considered at the meeting. Of that number, 472,037 Class A shares and 834,802,274 Class B shares are represented at this meeting by proxies returned through Thursday evening, April 30th.
Thank you. That number represents a quorum, and we will therefore directly proceed with the meeting. First order of business will be a reading of the minutes of the last meeting of shareholders. I recognize Ms. Debbie Bozanic, who will place a motion before the meeting.
I move that the reading of the minutes of the last meeting of shareholders be dispensed with and the minutes be approved.
Do I hear a second?
I second the motion.
The motion is carried. The next item of business is to elect directors. I recognize Ms. Debbie Pasanik to place motion before the meeting with respect to election of directors.
I move that Warren Buffett, Charles Munger, Gregory Abel, Howard Buffett, Stephen Burke, Kenneth Chenault, Susan Decker, David Gottesman, Charlotte Guyman, Ajit Jain, Thomas Murphy, Ronald Olson, Walter Scott, and Merrill Whitmer be elected as directors.
I second the motion.
It has been moved and seconded that Warren Buffett, Charles Munger, Greg Abel, Howard Buffett, Steve Burke, Ken Chenault, Susan Decker, David Gottesman, Charlotte Guyman, Ajit Jain, Tom Murphy, Ron Olson, Walter Scott, and Merrill Whitmer be elected as directors. The nominations are ready to be acted upon. Mr. Jackson, when you're ready, you may give your report.
My report is ready. The ballot of the proxy holders in response to proxies that were received through last Thursday evening cast not less than 543,203 votes for each nominee. That number exceeds a majority of the number of the total votes of all Class A and Class B shares outstanding. The certification required by Delaware law of the precise count of the votes will be given to the secretary to be placed with the minutes of this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Jaskin. Warren Buffett, Charles Munger, Greg Abel, Howard Buffett, Steve Burke, Ken Chenault, Susan Decker, David Gottesman, Charlotte Guyman, Ajit Jain, Tom Murphy, Ron Olson, Walter Scott, and Merrill Whitmer have been elected as directors. And Ken, if you're watching or listening, Ken Chenault, our new director, actually got the highest vote of all the directors, well ahead of me, I might add. So congratulations, Ken. The next item on the agenda is an advisory vote on the compensation of Berkshire Hathaway's executive officers. I recognize Ms. Debbie Bosanic to place a motion before the meeting on this item.
I move that the shareholders of the company approve on an advisory basis the compensation paid to the company's named executive officers as disclosed pursuant to item 402 of Regulation SK, including the compensation discussion and analysis, the accompanying compensation tables, and the related narrative discussion in the company's 2020 annual meeting proxy statement.
I second the motion.
It has been moved and seconded that the shareholders of the company approve on an advisory basis the compensation paid to the company's named executive officers. Mr. Jackson, when you are ready, you may give your report.
My report is ready. The ballot of the proxy holders in response to proxies that were received through last Thursday evening cast not less than 519,750 votes to approve on an advisory basis the compensation to the company's named executive officers. The compensation paid to the company's named executive officers. That number exceeds a majority of the number of the total votes of all Class A and Class B shares outstanding. Certification required by Delaware law of the precise count of the votes will be given to the secretary to be placed with the minutes of this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Deck. The motion to approve on an advisory basis the compensation paid to the company's named executive officers has passed. The next item on the agenda is an advisory vote on the frequency of a shareholder advisory vote on compensation of Berkshire Hathaway's executive officers. I recognize Ms. Debbie Pasanik to place a motion before the meeting on this item.
I move that the shareholders of the company determine on an advisory basis the frequency, whether annual, biennial, or triennial, with which they shall have an advisory vote on the compensation paid to the company's named executive officers as set forth in the company's 2020 annual meeting proxy statement.
I second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded that the shareholders of the company determine the frequency with which they shall have an advisory vote on compensation of named executive officers, with the option being every 1, 2, or 3 years. Mr. Jaksich, when you are ready, you may give your report.
My report is ready. The ballot of the proxy holders in response to proxies that were received through last Thursday evening casts 131,443 votes for a frequency of every year, 2,228 votes for a frequency of every 2 years, and 419,984 votes for a frequency of every 3 years of an advisory vote on the compensation paid to the company's named executive officers. The certification required by Delaware law of the precise count of the votes will be given to the secretary to be placed with the minutes of this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Jaksich. The shareholders of the company have determined on an advisory basis that they shall have an advisory vote on the compensation paid to the company.
Thanks for listening to this section of the Berkshire Hathaway's annual Shareholders Meeting podcast. The next section can be found in the next episode in your podcast feed. Please go check it out. If you enjoy this podcast, leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.